Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 4.67, The World Turned Upside Down. As the bedraggled British Army marched out of Yorktown on October 19th, possibly, although not certainly, to the tune of The World Turned Upside Down, the world had indeed changed. Except for those on the ground that day, they were unaware of just how much the world had indeed been turned upside down. This week, I want to pick up and look at the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Yorktown, and then look at the question of just how the Battle of Yorktown would ultimately become the final major engagement during the American Revolution. This will, thankfully, be the final narrative episode of our fourth season. After today, we are going to have a final episode, which is going to take the place of what had traditionally been our season in review. That episode is going to serve as more of a bookend, where we are going to try to fit the events into a more meaningful context. We then are going to move on to our fifth season, which, if you're curious, is going to take us all the way from the end of the Revolution up through the presidency of John Quincy Adams. So we are going to be covering a lot of ground that season, and I actually anticipate it will be a longer season than this season has been. With all of that said, let's jump back into our story and examine how exactly the world was turned upside down in Yorktown. The night of the British surrender would prove to be a telling moment for the young United States. That night, predicated on war being a gentlemanly endeavor, Washington threw a party where senior leadership for both the Allies and the British were invited, with the notable exception of Bannister Tarleton, who the Americans considered to be a war criminal. During the party, the Americans were surprised to find themselves as being the odd man out. The French and the British, well, they got along great. In his book, Victory at Yorktown, Richard Ketchum explains that the French nobles, who made up the officer corps, simply had more in common with the British upper-class officers than they did with the Americans. Both the French and the British were European. They had been raised with what they believed to be a proper upbringing. At the end of the day, the French may have allied themselves to the American cause, but let us not look past the fact that the Americans were little more than some backwater provincials. Just to really push this point home, Ketchum explains that upon learning that Lord Cornwallis was so broke after Yorktown that he could not afford to pay his troops, Rochambeau went ahead and loaned him the money to pay those troops. The British would repay the French general and sent along a few hundred bottles of wine as a thank you. This speaks to concepts of nationalism during the pre-French Revolution portion of the 18th century. Chiefly, as we can see during that party after Yorktown, it was class distinctions more than any kind of nationalistic feelings that dictated whom the officer corps felt most comfortable with. This was not something missed by the Americans either, who chafed at the apparent slight. This encounter that night is of very minor importance. However, I bring it up as we look forward to the next season. As we are going to see, no matter how much the United States might wish to remain aloof of European affairs, that is always going to prove to be nearly impossible. This incident merely exhibits some foreshadowing of the difficulties that would appear in the years following the Revolution, and how the European powers viewed the United States. Parties and celebrations aside, the loss at Yorktown was a major setback for the British war effort, costing them roughly a quarter of their North American force. However, it wasn't exactly so catastrophic that the loss alone demanded the end of hostilities. The British still maintained a significant force in New York, as well as smaller, but not entirely insignificant armies in Charleston, Canada, and Halifax. Combined, the British had approximately 30,000 troops still in North America alone. This is discounting any reinforcements that might be called up from the West Indies. Therefore, as bad as the loss at Yorktown was, it did not necessarily have to mark the end of the war. the British still had sufficient forces in North America to pose a considerable risk for the United States. This was not something lost upon George Washington. As early as September, he was asking de Grasse not to withdraw the fleet all the way south to the West Indies, but rather to head south and hit Charleston. De Grasse was not interested. Now, if you will recall from last time, he was not terribly interested in remaining in Yorktown either, and had to be talked into it by Lafayette. Once de Grasse sailed south, the British were going to once again have an overwhelming command over the American waterways. Within a few days of the surrender, Washington was indeed trying to figure out what comes next. He made one final attempt to get de Grasse to sail to Charleston. However, he had already decided that he was going to leave immediately for the West Indies. Washington wrote to Green on October 31st, letting him know of this final attempt to sway de Grasse to attack Charleston, and the Admiral's ultimate decision to decline, explaining that the excuse by the French was that it was simply too late in the season, and that the French court wanted the fleet back in the West Indies. Green, for his part, had largely regained control over the Carolina backcountry, and with Cornwallis knocked out of the fight, Virginia was now secure as well. Washington agreed to peel off some of his men to back up Nathaniel Green, who was going to remain in the south, while Washington and the remainder of the Continentals made their way back to the north, up to the Hudson, and to the ever-elusive target of New York. As we examine the stipulations of the surrender, I want to take a moment and look at one group that was particularly affected by the British surrender. We have, over the last several episodes, spoken of the plight of the African Americans who fought for the British at Yorktown. So many of these people had escaped bondage and had taken that calculated risk to flee into British lines. However, as we had discussed last week, when food became short, Cornwallis sent them back towards the Allied lines and back into an uncertain future that almost certainly would include a return to bondage. Of the 4,000 to 5,000 African American men and women who served under Cornwallis in some capacity, around half of them had survived. In the aftermath of the surrender, half of those survivors found themselves being put right back into slavery. During the drafting of the treaty, the African American population inside of Yorktown was a specific point that was addressed. Following the end of the siege, people from all over the South converged on Yorktown to see if their missing slaves might just be amongst Cornwallis's army. Well, many found that those whom they had previously enslaved had died during the war. Countless others were returned to slavery. Among the people to recover slaves in Yorktown was Thomas Jefferson, who recaptured 6 of his own fugitive slaves. In the coming episodes, we are going to talk more about slavery and really start to see the beginnings of an emerging divide in the country over it. As we move through next season, we are going to increasingly see the politics over the institution of slavery shape the direction of the country during the early Republic and increasingly as we move towards what we all know is going to be a future conflict. A final group in Yorktown that would be deeply affected by the surrender were the Loyalists, who were seemingly under Cornwallis's protection. Cornwallis did make some overtures towards protecting both the Loyalist population as well as the African American population during the surrender negotiations. However, as I mentioned a moment ago, Washington was not interested either in protecting the rights of the black men and women still in Yorktown, nor in protecting the rights of the Loyalists. This would cause a considerable amount of distrust between the Loyalist population and the British leadership. William Franklin complained in a letter back to Lord Germain that the Loyalist population felt that this had been nothing short of a double cross. Had they not remained loyal subjects of their king in a time when that was a very dangerous position to take? Had they not fought against the Patriot forces to try and restore order in the colonies? And now, their government was just going to abandon them to the rabble? As this news spread, it caused a considerable amount of fear in the Loyalist camps throughout the entire country. The Loyalists who remained in New York worried that, should the war fall apart, as it looked like it very well may be doing at the end of 1781. Would they too be abandoned to the mobs of angry patriots? Franklin would push on Clinton to treat loyalists, essentially as he would prisoners of war, by which he meant affording them certain protections and attempting to guarantee their safety. This is something that Clinton agreed to do, although it is worth noting that Clinton did decline Franklin's suggestion that retribution be taken against the American captives, should the loyalists suffer any mistreatment. Before we head across the Atlantic and begin examining exactly how Yorktown would wind up becoming the last major engagement in the war in North America, I want to remain in the United States for a moment and look at the response to the victory domestically first. On October 20th, Washington dispatched Trench Tillman to ride as quickly as he could to Philadelphia to share the news of the victory. Now, as an interesting aside, this assignment was given to Tillman as something of a reward for years of faithful service to Washington. So, despite the fact that Tillman was dealing with illness at the time, this was a pretty big honor for the man, and he was not about to turn it down. Unfortunately for him, news of the surrender had actually already been sent to Philadelphia. Determined to be the first to bring the news, you end up with a situation where Tillman, despite being sick, raced to Philadelphia, determined to beat the mail, and just basically tell everybody that he could as he sprinted on past. Now, as it turns out, despite this desperate ride, Tillman would lose the race. Thankfully for him, in an era where dispatches could easily be wrong, recall the powder alarm for instance, and how much that interrupted the First Continental Congress, the delegates were happy to hear the news from Tillman directly. As the surrendered standards of the defeated army were presented to Congress, the scope of the victory set in. Celebrations rang out throughout the city. Reports from Philadelphia that day talk of spontaneous celebrations erupting in the streets. Cannons, both in front of the State House and in the harbor, were fired in celebration. This is a scene that would play out all over the country as celebrations erupted at the news of the great victory. In a moment that is going to have a bit of foreshadowing for our next season, I do want to mention one seemingly minor but very telling incident that occurred with Tillman shortly after his arrival. Tillman went to Congress and requested reimbursement for his travel expenses, which seems to be a rather routine ask, not something that should be a big deal at all. Well, as it turns out, this was a problem. Congress did not have the money to reimburse Tillman, and instead the delegates to Congress essentially had to crowdsource the payments to the man from their own pockets. We are going to be talking so much more about the economy of the United States in the aftermath of Yorktown at the beginning of our next season. However, suffice it to say that this is a pretty clear sign of just how the government was doing at the end of 1781. Somewhat ironically, in the celebrations, Congress also voted to build a monument in Yorktown to commemorate the victory. However, if you can't even cover the travel expenses of Trench Tillman, you can guess at just how much ability they had to follow up on this particular endeavor. If you're wondering, and saying to yourself, hey wait, there is a monument at Yorktown. Well, yes, you are correct, there is indeed a monument there today. However, that's not going to be built for another 100 years. The victory at Yorktown, more than just causing celebrations, would, in due time, help influence the eventual peace negotiations and the amount of leverage that the Americans held in said peace talks. John Adams, who was easily the most vocal member of the American Peace Commission, was advocating for the need of a major victory in the South to swing events in favor of the Americans, in a moment where the concept of uni possidetis still reigned supreme. Henry Knox wrote on October 21st to Adams that, "Your ideas of the necessity of some important blow to the British power in the southern states were extremely just. The reasons are too obvious to be mentioned. I am happy, my dear sir, in having it in my power to announce to you the joyful event of the reduction of Lord Cornwallis and his whole force in Virginia. The very next day, it was Washington himself who would rush off a letter to John Adams. The victory also meant that the always busy American press needed to decide how to frame events. The press had, throughout the entire duration of the war, been instrumental in helping frame the fight. Now, initially what came out of the press is what you would expect. Reporting on the details throughout the first month following the victory was common, a way to discuss just how vast the American victory really had been. These reports often contained information as to the specifics, such as the men and supplies captured, to in-depth reporting about the widespread celebrations going on all over the country. This, however, was only going to go so far. The press was going to need to milk every last bit possible out of the situation. What is not surprising necessarily is that the narrative shifted to slavery. All throughout the American Revolution, there had been repeated attempts by the press to use the threat of slave rebellion or Indian uprisings as a means by which to bind the colonies together. As we have talked about time and time again, few things caused more fear for the average American than did these two very real threats. We saw this back in June 1777, when John Burgoyne managed to make himself just about the most hated man in all of North America, with his threats of unleashing native tribes on the American population. This was such a serious fear to the population at large that we see both the incitement of slave rebellions and the courting of native tribes as items mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. What is more surprising here, though, is exactly how the story would be developed. The narrative being put forward was not squarely focused on the British encouraging an uprising, but rather on the treatment of the slaves who found themselves fighting for Cornwallis. As we have already talked about today, the conditions for those African Americans who did choose to take their shot at freedom and defect across British lines were some of the most appalling in the entire Battle of Yorktown. The American press did not skip on the opportunity to attack Cornwallis for his abysmal treatment of the African Americans that had fought for him. Oftentimes, these attacks were wrapped in accusations of Cornwallis sending those infected with smallpox into the American ranks. At the same time, American writers would publish articles that were, at least they wanted their readers to believe, from the perspective of the affected African Americans. Historian Robert Parkinson argues that the purpose of this was to link Cornwallis to the black population, in a fashion not unsimilar to how Burgoyne was linked to the Indians in the aftermath of Saratoga. Incidentally, Parkinson also points out that although papers were quick to report on the abuses of Cornwallis of those African Americans who had joined his ranks, they were notably silent on the fact that black men also fought for the United States in Yorktown. Rhode Island had long welcomed African Americans into their ranks, often in exchange for emancipation. If you'll recall, Christopher Greene, the brother of Nathaniel Greene, was the leader of this regiment, although he was killed in action when his headquarters was ambushed by a group of Loyalists in May 1781. These men were present and fighting for the United States in Yorktown. This, however, was never part of the narrative that was being presented to the American people, many of whom would still be very uncomfortable with the idea of intentionally arming the African Americans, to say nothing over the question of granting emancipation to slaves who joined to fight for the Americans. In some cases, there was no promise of emancipation in exchange for service. In the case of James Armistead, he had served Cornwallis directly. Imagine, therefore, the surprised shock that Cornwallis received when he learned that Armistead had been a spy all along, feeding information to the Americans. Yet, this daring act had come with no promise of freedom as a reward for hard service. It was, in fact, not until Lafayette personally appealed to the Virginia legislature on his behalf in 1787 that Armistead would be granted his freedom. He would thereafter go by the name of James Armistead Lafayette. Of course, the purpose of including such stories, such as the atrocities against the Black who had fled to Cornwallis, were not meant to elicit sympathy, but rather were intended to show the villainous nature of their now defeated adversary. As Parkinson points out, these stories that were allegedly coming from Black witnesses often included clarification from the publishers that these stories were coming from honest Black people. This had the effect of taking previous prejudices and using them to tell the American story from a unique perspective. This brings us to perhaps the most obvious question. How exactly did Yorktown convince the British that it was finally time to throw in the towel? The British were sick to death of the war by the time that 1782 began. They had spent the last 20 years dealing with headache after headache from their North American colonies. The last 7 years had found them move from resistance and the melting away of imperial authority in their colonies to a provincial civil war, and then finally into a global conflict where there was no shortage of rivals who were eager to poke them in the eye with a sharp stick. Even before Yorktown, the British were seemingly looking for a way out. Back in 1778, they had sent over the failed Carlisle Commission, which was prepared to cave on just about every demand from 1774 and 1775. As we had talked about back in episode 4.50, this came too late to salvage anything. Making matters worse was that the British were not exactly doing that well in North America. Even at their best, they had never managed to score a dramatic victory over the Americans that would threaten the overall war effort. Really, the closest that they ever came was the near complete destruction of the American Southern Army following Camden. Yet even then, they failed to ever get sufficient control over the backcountry of the Carolinas to fully secure their holdings. Within just 2 months of that otherwise devastating loss, the Americans would begin to slowly but surely reverse their losses, beginning with that victory at King's Mountain. We are going to spend more time in our next episode discussing the failures of the British war effort. But for right now, we can say that the British had spent a whole lot of the war being significantly frustrated by the Americans. Now, for a second time in the war, the British had suffered a major loss that would, at a minimum, require a reconsideration of the strategic aims for the war, as had been the case in 1777, after the loss of Burgoyne's army at Saratoga. The British once again found themselves having had an entire army captured. Where things differed, however, is that it was no longer 1777. The war was not entering into its third year. Now it was 1781 and the war was getting ready to enter into its seventh year. Since the loss of Saratoga, the British had racked up massive amounts of debt. They had first the French, and then the Spanish, enter into the war against them. Yet they still had very little to show for their efforts. When the news of Yorktown reached London, it made everybody pause and question exactly what was happening in North America. The news of what had happened first reached London at the end of November. The gravity of the situation was lost on nobody. Lord North reportedly exclaimed, "Oh God, it's all over," when he learned of the defeat. There was a real concern, too, that the impetus for the loss at Yorktown had been a French naval victory. In a moment when the British were feeling particularly low, many began to question if the entire empire was in danger from the French navy. George III reacted by agreeing that it was time to grant Clinton's wish and accept his now persistent requests to resign, selecting Guy Carleton to replace him. This, though, presented a problem. Lord Germain and Carleton were not on good terms. And in fact, they had been longtime bitter rivals going all the way back to the French and Indian War. Carleton had zero interest in serving under Germain. This would prove to be a critical development, because as support for the American War of Independence began to collapse following the news of Yorktown, Germain remained one of the last diehard supporters of continuing the fight. Now, though, with the war quickly losing favor, Germain quickly found himself losing support. By the beginning of 1782, if it was a question between Carleton and Germain, the conclusion was clear. Germain had overstayed his welcome, and he needed to go. Indeed, the entire North ministry was quickly falling apart. Although it seems that George III actually wanted to fight on, and would make some overtures about trying to salvage the war, in Parliament, they were completely over it. On February 27th, 1782, the House of Commons voted to stop fighting the war in North America. At the beginning of March, Germain would step down, opening a spot for Carleton to take over the war effort in North America. Finally, at the end of the month, with no other options available, Lord North himself took the hint, and by the end of the month, he resigned and his ministry collapsed. The resignation of Germain, and then the total collapse of the North ministry, marked the end of the final bits of support that remained for the war. George III tried to influence events and get Lord Shelburne to head a new ministry. However, he proved uninterested in jumping into that hornet's nest. Instead, it was Lord Rockingham who returned to lead the new ministry. Way back, it had been Rockingham who had recognized the writing on the wall when it came to the Stamp Act. Back then, he saw that the merchants had no stomach for continuing the prosecution of the Stamp Act and understood that, despite the wishes of his king to stand his ground, it was something that nobody really wanted. Now, as then, in 1782, Rockingham was again in a position to acknowledge that there was no longer any appetite to continue the war, once again contrary to the wishes of his monarch. Shelburne would remain involved, somewhat ironically, as the Minister of the Southern Department, which, if you'll recall, oversaw the now acknowledged, soon-to-be former colonies. This meant that right from the very beginning of the Rockingham ministry, that would have to negotiate the end of the war, it began on a footing of animosity and personal dislike for one another. Making matters even worse, George III refused to talk to Rockingham, making Shelburne the somewhat unwitting go-between for the two men. Shelburne is something of an interesting figure here. Although by 1782, he too recognized that the British needed out of the war, he remained opposed to outright independence for the colonies, instead hoping that an agreement along the lines of what the Carlisle Commission had presented back in 1778 might prevail. Next season, as we transition from the Revolution into the early Republic, we will be spending more time tracing the peace process. The final peace between the British and the United States is going to be complicated by the fact that there were other allies who had their own demands and personal aims. Recall that the United States was bound not to forge a separate peace with the British, separate of her French allies. The Spanish, who still were not actually allied with the United States directly, had their own demands that they wished to secure in the peace. However, one thing seemed abundantly clear. If the British were unable to secure a situation roughly akin to the modern British Commonwealth, two nations with a sovereign parliament yet joint monarch, back in 1778 following their defeat at Saratoga, there was virtually no hope of accomplishing that end in 1782. The British had less leverage and were that much more exhausted by 7 years of a war that had left them with absolutely nothing to show for it. By the end of March 1782, all but a few ardent holdouts had accepted that an independent United States was now an inevitability. There is so much that we can say about the Battle of Yorktown. The effect of the British loss leads directly to the end of the war. In so many ways, the battle symbolizes why the British ultimately lost the war. We are going to talk about this in depth next time as we write a postscript on this season. However, suffice it to say that the Battle of Yorktown never should have happened in the first place. Clinton had forced Cornwallis into a position where he was dangerously exposed to getting cut off and trapped, which is exactly what happened. Cornwallis, on the other hand, then just sits around, desperately hoping to be relieved by Clinton, despite his officers telling him, begging him, that if he doesn't break out, he is going to get trapped. This seeming collapse in strategic thinking would doom the British Southern Army and would begin the chain of events that would lead to the end of the war. It is, of course, impossible to say what would have happened if Clinton hadn't forced Cornwallis into an impossible decision, or if Cornwallis had tried to escape earlier, while such options still existed. The belligerents were tired of fighting, and foreign courts were offering to mediate peace settlements. Both the French and the British were looking at the spiraling costs from the war and were increasingly ready to listen. Without Yorktown, the Americans may well have entered into those talks with far less leverage than they did. In that situation, maybe the final peace sees Georgia, or even the Carolinas, revert back to British control. Maybe Washington gets his great battle in New York and defeats Clinton soundly. And this is all a moot point. What we do know, however, is that the Battle of Yorktown did mark the end of the British prosecution of the war. And so, we too shall use it to mark the end of the Revolution. Next time, we are going to have our final episode of Season 4, where we step back and try to figure out exactly what had just happened. What had started as a policy to keep American settlers out of the Ohio country, and then some months later a tax cut on molasses, had, in less than 20 years' time, led to the loss of much of the British North American holdings and the independence of the United States. Next time we are going to attempt to figure out exactly how we got here, and just what it means for the future. Until then, I hope you all have a fantastic 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we tie a bow on the American Revolution.